Okay, all right. Hello, hello, hello. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. How is everybody today? Good afternoon, good evening, and good night. We live, we live. Before anyone asks, this stream, like all my others, will be available on the live stream playlist, so you can always check it out. If you have to pop in now and you can't stay for the whole thing, the live stream playlist on my channel is where you can get any of my live streams. I don't keep them on the regular feed, because I just don't like how it looks. But yeah. So today is a very special stream. It's a little something different. I mean, technically, I have done Q&A interview with another creator of some sort before. But this is my first time. This will be my first time interviewing an artist. It'll be my first time interviewing a solo punk artist. It'll be my first time going over, their art and discussing their ideas and stuff. And you all know this is a topic I'm passionate about, solar punk and art and that sort of thing. So it's really nice to be able to interview this creator and get a better sense of how they go about doing things, because their work really is an inspiration to me personally. And I hope that their artwork can be an inspiration to you all as well, and that you'll get a lot of good out of what they have and what they've created. I'm gonna let them in a minute. Okay, all right. I see. I forgot to mute the stream. Right. So we have 51 people watching already. I think that's enough. Let's get Dustin into the stream. Don't forget to like the stream if you're enjoying it. And let me just call. And y'all, please let me know if the audio is too loud, too soft, or whatever the case may be. I'm gonna call him now. Welcome, welcome.
Andrew.
Hey, Dustin. How are you
Hi,
doing?
Andrew.
I'm gonna make sure that everyone's hearing you.
Yeah, I didn't hear you quite well, so.
Oh, you're not hearing me well?
No, I hear you. Yes,
Okay.
it's okay now. Yes.
All right. And just waiting on feedback from the comments to make sure they're hearing you.
Okay, so I'm saying something, so I hope everybody can hear me. Hi, everybody.
Testing, testing. Okay, I think they
Yes.
are hearing you. Excellent. So I suppose we can
Loud and clear.
jump right into this. People are saying they can hear you just fine. So let's get right into it.
Okay, great.
It's a pleasure to have you on, to be able to talk about your art, to ask some questions, even get some questions from the audience as well. Like I told you before we got started, I don't want to keep you too long, so this may be about an hour and a half stream. But for those in the audience, basically, I'm going to be asking him some questions. We're going to be looking at some of his art and discussing that art, and then finally, we'll take some of your questions as well near the end. And so inevitably, I suppose my first question, Dustin, is how do you define solar punk, and what drew you to this particular subgenre of speculative fiction and art?
Okay. Andrew, I have a background. When I was in my 20s, I had was involved in environmentalism as an activist, and partly as an artist. I have a background as a designer, so I participated in many projects that all try to create a better world in different disciplines. But for about 10 years ago, I realized that a new narrative is something that is really needed. And as an artist, you can help in realizing, making this realization of a new narrative. You can make this possible with your art and the explanatory texts that you add to the art. So futurism was from then on my main topic, and I explored it in different ways. And when I saw that solarpunk emerged, I actually worked together with a science fiction writer who tried to describe his vision on solarpunk, and I realized the genre being quite new. It already existed for some time, but it was becoming more popular. And from then on, I tried to label my own artwork as solarpunk, as well, in order to help creating this new narrative. So
And the author
that's
you
how I
worked
got
with,
involved.
that was Mark LaRochelle, right?
I worked with Eric Hunting, an American science fiction writer who has been, who's been in the field for years, worked on many science fiction novels and books, and has done quite some research about diverse, different science fiction and futurism topics. And he made a book that has been published in English and in Italian about solarpunk. And I did some of the sketches for his book.
Awesome. And so where does Mark LaRochelle come into play with that, with Arcton?
Well, Mark, yeah, that's actually a book. Many of the illustrations that you can see on my website as well are part of a book that is now being made. It's not been published yet, but I got the approval to share the illustrations already on social media and on my site. And it's a vision about the some parts of Canada, New Brunswick in particular. It's based on the general concepts and ideas about solarpunk future. And I collaborated with Mark to make the illustrations, in which I actually got an enormous amount of freedom to portray how I saw it. So it was a nice co-creation process. But the book has not yet been published. It's still, I think, three or four chapters still need to be written, and I need to make some illustrations as well.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to it eventually coming out. Any
Yeah.
idea for the timeline on that?
No, I'm still waiting on Mark to share his new chapters. So I hope that in 2024 those will be finished, and then we'll see if there's more information available for real publication date and when the book come out. Yes.
Gotcha. If you were to, I guess, summarize what you're trying to convey, what message you're trying to share in all your pieces over your entire career, what would you say that message is?
Well, my more recent work, so I evolved, but my more recent work is always focused on the multitude of species that our planet is rich of many other species. So, but as you know, human species has always been the more dominant species, and I try to look at any intervention that we do as a human species. So, talking about architecture design, and trying to look at it, how can we design or create, build things, but by building it, how can we improve the life of other species? Can be plant life or animal life or other forms of life, instead of ruining it, which actually happens now often. And how can we go further and become some form of caretaker for other species, and create urban environments that are an integral part of an already existing natural ecosystem? So that's how I try to work now.
That's fantastic, and it definitely comes through in your art. I really see that dedication, that focus on integrating other species in human environments and really blurring the lines between the human and the natural, because we are part of nature at the end of the day.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think many of the problems that we're facing, if you look at it from a caretaker perspective, and if you would look at the human species as some form of shepherd that takes care of many other species, and you handle problems that we are facing now from that perspective, then you will solve many of the problems as well. For instance, if you would say an earthworm, if you would say when we do something, we want that the end result will be that the earthworm, his habitat isn't destroyed, well, then you nurture the soil. You will not poison the soil. You will make it possible that water can infiltrate in the soil. You will respect the biodiversity of different plant species, native species, so they can feed with the organic litter and matter that that feeds the worm as well. And if you do such actions in, for instance, an urban environment, you tackle problems like heating, that's a particular problem in a city, soil pollution, water that can't, that runoff water that can be a threat in cities like floods and stuff like that. But it's from the perspective of taking care for other species. So that's another way of looking at design and architecture.
A lot of times we look at these problems and it's just like, oh, how are they affecting us as humans? When, we really should be looking at how it's affecting other species as well, and how we can accommodate those species in solving those problems so that everyone benefits.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's a lot of focus on nature and the environment and other species in your work, but I'm sure, as a lot of people are familiar with solar punk, know there's also a lot of focus on technology in solar punk. Now, as some of my audience already knows, my position on technology on solar punk leans a lot more in the quote unquote low tech direction than the sort of high future possibilities that are presented in other works, though I do, see space for that as well. So my question for you is, how do you incorporate technologies? Where do you see technology fitting into solar punk and in your solar punk creations?
Well, first of all, I never seen technology in itself as the problem, but how you apply and use technology. You can have a shovel and use it as a weapon to kill somebody, for instance, but you can use it to do agriculture as well. And I think with many of the technologies that we have, they can be great technology, but if you use it in consumption society and you want to sell it to any single individual on Earth, then it becomes an unsustainable technology. If you use it for wars or for production in an undesired manner and in an unsustainable manner, then it becomes an unwanted or an unnecessary technology. So I think the system somehow makes us use technology in a bad way. But of course, low-tech technology is key in many of the artworks that I make as well.
When it comes
Yes.
to, I suppose, the how you go about creating your work, right? Could you walk me through the process and any potential challenges that you face along that process of bringing these things into fruition?
Yeah, well, there are several aspects. First of all, nature has been a teacher for, I think, almost all artists or researchers or designers. Nature shows you how it solves many problems when we can actually learn so many things from it. And it has been applied many times in architecture and in design as well, and it inspires me as well, because I believe in a distant future, we will need to make the transition towards a society which the the border between nature and the urban habitat blurs, becomes more blurry, and it integrates more in the pristine nature, and the urban habitat can become more one with the outer natural world. So nature has always been one of my my key inspirations, and co-creation processes. So I always look into what others have designed. There are actually so many great initiatives and work to be found everywhere. And what I mostly do is I just scale it up. So if I see something that's applied somewhere that is very inspirational, I try to imagine what would it be if this would be used on a larger scale.
Right.
Instead of somewhere in a small community, what would it be if this would be used by a large community within a city? And
could you give me an example of what you're referring to?
It can be all sort of things. It can be a way of harvesting rainwater that is used by a small NGO and in some sort of social project. But if you look into it and you see, yes, this is applied with low-tech technology that can be manufactured locally, because sometimes what NGOs do is they try to seek for solutions that are very have a low threshold and that can be produced locally. And I see it and I think this can be applied as well in an independent community within a city, let's say in a neighborhood that forms one community and that takes over the means of production and uses this tool of harvesting water on a local scale and use it for making it drinkable water or use it for irrigation in their urban gardens, agricultural gardens, stuff like that. See something and try to see what can I do within it, within an urban context. And it can be rather simple things or even historical things that have been. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. If you look into what futurists from the past have devised and thought about and designed, you could reintroduce it in a solar punk jacket and a solar punk atmosphere as well. So
and
these are some examples.
The innovations and technologies developed by indigenous peoples around the world and how they've applied their ideas in their unique local contexts and seeing how that could be applied elsewhere as well.
Absolutely, yes. I think that is a key element of solarpunk as well. There's so much strength within local indigenous communities, neglected knowledge that has been dominated by a more industrial Western thought, and I think they need to be revalued. And there are the people out there who have such knowledge or are interested in it, and it could apply it and try to envision it in a solar punk context. That's absolutely a key element of solar punk, I think.
Agreed. Are there any other artists and that really inspire your artwork that you want to give a chance to shout out?
Yeah, absolutely. There is. So I'm, for the people who are listening, I'm from Belgium. Perhaps not everybody is familiar with Belgium. It's a tiny country in Western Europe. And Belgium has quite a rich tradition of artists. And there's an artist over here who's an architect from profession. He's called Luc Schouten. I can.
Oh, that is, he's one of my favorite.
Put it in the chat box.
One of my favorite artists.
Yeah, I met him once and I saw his work in Brussels. And I don't think he will define his work as solarpunk. Although a year ago he gave an exhibition in which he used the term solarpunk as well. He has been working for a long time about what he calls a vegetal city, a city that's that mimics a plant ecosystem, a natural ecosystem, and he always comes back to other forms of materials. So he steps away from concrete, steel, And that has quite been an inspiration for me. And he actually has a brother who's a famous comic illustrator who makes marvelous illustrations as well. Perhaps less solar punk, but as an artist, it's great. I admire his work. And his brother's called François Schuiten. There are other artists, Malcolm Wells, an American architect who is perhaps one of the forefathers of subterranean houses, and his work comes from the idea and the vision of each intervention that you do when you build something disturbs an ecosystem, an existing ecosystem that's quite balanced from itself. And so what he says is, if we go to a certain depth and be on a subterranean level, and we can build there, and we can cover the roofs that are partly subterranean with soil, we disturb the local ecosystem as little as possible. So we disturb it when we build, but afterwards it can become a more natural ecosystem as it was before. And he was quite an inspiration as well for me. Of course, the existing artists like Solieri, and there are quite some present day artists as well that are interesting to look at. If you just use the hashtag solarpunk art, you'll find interesting solarpunk artists for sure on Instagram and other social media.
For sure. You'll have to send me the names of the other artists you shouted out, because I was familiar with Luke, but I was not familiar with the others. So,
okay,
send those, great. And I'll put them in the chat and stuff.
Yeah. I see you scrolling and showing the Vegetal City, so that's... unfortunately, yeah. Many of his books are in French, so he's French-speaking, and he didn't. So for those... I've searched myself for Lucas' work in English, and it's difficult to find books written in English. Yeah.
You say Wallonia. You say, unfortunately, French. Am I to assume that you're...
Yeah.
From the German side of Belgium?
The Dutch side, yes. Belgium has French and the Dutch side, Dutch-speaking.
Right.
But I can read French as well, so for me it's not that much of a problem. So I have bought his books in French, but I'm more used to speaking English.
Right. I had also wanted to ask you if you had any advice that you would give to aspiring artists looking to create work in the solarpunk genre.
Well, something that I think is quite important, I see many artists that are interested by solarpunk, and that's a very fortunate and very good trend. But what they always should realize that solarpunk exists out of two words, solar and punk. The most obvious one that everybody catches quite fastly is solar, which of course refers to solar energy. And what you see then is that people devise cities or design cities or other images where they portray solar panels in some sort of futuristic form, and they show other forms of renewable energy like wind energy. Often you see them portraying trees on roofs, nice concepts, worth looking into it. But the second word, punk, must not be neglected. Its second word is punk, which is derived from the punk counterculture that creates a counterculture against the existing ruling culture, the dominant culture. And I think that is one of the main problems with our current society, that we desperately need another governance model, another economic model. And many of the words that you will find if you search for solarpunk manifestos and definitions, you will see that it is community-based, that it relates to the commons, relates to other manners of using land, this bottom-up grassroots vibe. And I think this needs to be, if you're an artist, you need to think about that as well. How can we portray these elements? How can we always try to envision and think, how can this contribute to a bottom-up, decentralized model where we can use other models than the existing suppressing and oppressing centralized model. So that would be nice if artists take that into account as well in their
Agreed,
work.
agreed, 100%. It really is a balance between those two, and I also want to point out as well, on the back on the solar side of the term solar punk, solar does not exclusively, imply solar panels. There are other aspects of solar energy that also deserve to be explored. In fact, I was reading about it earlier today. Some of the other uses of solar energy that go beyond solar panels, because solar panels have some of their issues, but solar energy is used in water heating, it's used in cooking, it's used in water treatment, it's used in, and yeah, I'm reading from the Wikipedia page, agriculture and horticulture, transportation. There's more to the solar aspect of solar punk than just solar panels being plastered everywhere. So try to be, trying to
Absolutely,
think creatively
absolutely.
about how else, you could apply that natural element.
Solar cooking is when and I have many examples of great solar cooking and solar furnaces. So
Agreed.
indeed, you can use the sun in many more ways than in a solar panel. Like you say, it has its own issues with rare metals and things like that.
Yeah. As I suppose now, because that's pretty much all I'd wanted to ask you. We can probably dive into some of your artwork, perhaps starting with the piece that I've had cycling here. What was the story
Okay.
behind this one?
Well, actually, these are also from a paper that I've done more recently, I think a year or 2 years ago, together with Eric Hunting, so the American science fiction writer. And he wrote a technical paper about how we can move from the present day situation towards what he calls a living city. And in order to get there, he describes in the different chapters what each stage could mean for the human species. And you can think about energy production, but also about means of transport, food production, how we produce tools, stuff like that. And he got the idea, I think it was from, if I recall it right, Crumb, the American illustrator who made once actually a quite futuristic series of art. He's more known for his other work, but he made an illustration, quite nice, where he shows a I don't know, I think it was a countryside village that evolves through time from the past to back then the present day and then to the future. But he used each time the same illustration to show how the landscape changes. And Eric had the idea to do the same thing with a more typical, well-known present day skyscraper city. And so that's how I started from the present, or perhaps a present day city, or a city how a city could look within 10 or 15 years. That's the starting point, and then how it evolves over time, without really labeling it like this is within 20 years, this is within 40 years, but it moves towards the end stage, and that's a living city, a holistic approach, a city that is actually unified with nature and with even the cosmos and everything. And this is what you see now on the screen is the starting point, where there's a city that's in falling apart and typical what's happening in our capitalistic society.
Yeah, we see a lot of, instances of really like social fragmentation. The person standing on the roof seems, more than distraught about their current circumstances. We see drones flying in the air. We see abandoned buildings that have fallen into disuse, and we see protests against the status quo.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately that's of course this illustration is meant to be symbolic, so I wouldn't say that it will exactly be like this, but I deliberately chose to depict this man with a costume because there's still a fair amount of people that is believing in the the narrative. If you work hard and if you do what the upper class does, then you move up on the ladder. But as you know, there's a glass ceiling. You can't become the elite. That's what they make you believe. And at a certain point, some people keep on believing that, and by believing it, supporting other powers, more conservative powers, till it comes to a point that they realize, oh my God, where are we now? What have we done? And some perhaps choose to end their life. I also tried, it's perhaps more difficult to see here, but to depict some trends that you see as well. So the rooftop gardens and the background of there are fires, but there are trees and plants growing out of the concrete. So people perhaps that are trying to change parking lots into tiny forests. There is protest, so people are trying to resist against what's happening. But the drone, as you said, also represents the state control or capitalist control, corporate control, the ruling elite that ne don't necessarily want something to change, and even profits from wars or a very polarized world. So that's possibly the state that our society will be in, and still a situation today, but hopefully we can go to next stages soon.
Yes. I really like the idea of these sort of seeds of solar punk being present even in that, degrading society. And now, of course, in this piece, we see a shift as I let the time progress a little bit.
I think, and actually, the next image that's comes next, this must be this one. I think this one and the one that I have seen some seconds, minutes ago, these situations are perhaps present day. So what you see here, this is in some cities already happening on a large scale as well. And you see here, it's more about adapting. So we didn't build those cities with the things that are happening today in our mind. So when they built those large cities like, I don't know, New York and Manhattan, they had prosperity in mind, and we will conquer the world, and after that we will conquer the moon, Mars, and the entire universe. But capitalism comes to its limits, and our cities aren't designed to be to withstand the disasters that are happening today, and that's actually what you see everywhere. But still, citizens and people living in cities need to do or need to use what's there, and there are the skeletons and the relics of the past, the cities that we live in today. And communities can, what they can do is try to adapt them, try to create them more resilient, make them more resilient, and that's what you're seeing here. They are more creative in using the space, the spaces of the city. And if you look at the city and you look with it with different glasses, then you see it are volumes that are now arbitrarily devised in private, public. But actually, if you would move towards a more point of view of using land and space from the perspective of the commons, then you have volumes that can be used for many, many generic volumes, which buildings are generic volumes in the end, and they can be used for whatever, for storage, for housing, And that's a little bit what's happening here. I think this is already happening, and I think this trend will be happening more and more in the further future.
Yes,
especially in places that are difficult to keep the control. It's impossible for the existing ruling elite to control everything on Earth. That's rather impossible. It will become more and more impossible.
Agreed. I'm assuming, like, obviously, like, each person who sees this piece is going to get, like, a different interpretation out of it. But something I just noticed, and I've looked at this piece so many times at this point, something I just noticed was that the abandoned building in the previous, the dilapidated building in the previous work of art is now it's been repainted, it's now in use by the people. You could see this as an example of, you know, squatters and the squatting movement seizing this property and transforming it for collective use. You could see it as, you know, a community land trust, establishing a hub in this building. But you're really seeing a lot more life and a lot more vibrancy. You're seeing the return of pedestrianism and stuff in this work, and it really hints as to what is to come later on.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if you look at the city, many of the spaces used for corporate use, offices that are standing empty during the weekends or during the evening, they can be used for many other functions. And it's space. If you would strip the building down, you have the rough fundaments of this building, and you can use it for whatever you want. And it comes to adaption, and how can we adapt and change, retrofit a city and its buildings for the community's needs. And what I also, it's a nice little thing that I added here, is I reused many of the billboards that are used by all corporations today, or multinational corporations, that they used for branding to promote their brands. But these billboards can be used to seal off buildings, or for material to build new structures, because perhaps in the nearby future, if the logistics of a capitalistic system begin to fail, and it's already failing, the relics of this industrial society can be used. So why not the billboards and promotional material of large multinationals as well? So that's a fun thing that I have added. And you can see, if you look into the picture, some of the well-known brands: Pepsi, IKEA, Tesla, whatever. Yeah.
Right. And then progressing into the next stage of transformation, it seems to be quite a radical leap. So what's taking place in this piece?
Don't see it changing yet, so perhaps there's some delay. Okay, now. Yeah, well, and at a certain point, so what's quite logical that will happen is that there will be, for quite some time, tension between the existing powers that will, like, they still have power, and with power I mean as long as there's one dominant monetary system, police or army can be paid to suppress and oppress people. It can be used for corrupt governments to create laws and arrest people if they don't follow the rules, because it's like with a game. I can design a game, we can all design games and say what the rules are, and everybody needs to follow the rules, and if you don't follow the rules, you lose the game. So we actually live in a world game, and if you don't follow the rules, then you can be arrested, or you can be can have a penalty on a punishment. And this will happen for quite some time, which makes it more difficult, and it's more, you could say, an era of survival. and adaption, there will be emerging great ideas, great community concepts, but at a certain point, you will get at a point where new communities become more and more powerful, become networks of communities, and networks, power lays within the network, not in single individuals or in one group of people. No, it's our communities that are interconnected with each other that generates the strength, because that's more diff it's very difficult to destroy a network. And at a certain point, a city can become a network of many, many resilient communities. And this is actually what's happening here. You still have the relics of the past, so we're not there yet that we can create new large forms of sustainable industry or manufacturing. We don't have perhaps new materials, so we need to deal with the materials that we have, perhaps still concrete and perhaps it's still steel, or but I assume many natural materials as well, thinking about bamboo, sustainable wood, hemp. You're familiar with the more sustainable natural materials. And
Yes.
this is what you see. They try to build and recreate in a more stable, balanced society where there's less conflict between the ruling elite and people, that communities that are from bottom up are rising, emerging. And you see the first forms of a new community-driven civilization where new forms of governance have emerged. So.
Right. I think one of the things you were talking about there with the networks that have developed in this stage of transformation, it's really well symbolized, I think, in the way that the buildings that were once separate, almost like silos of private property, now that they are shared, the people have realized we want to be able to connect with each other more easily, and so they've developed these bridges and walkways and connections between buildings that were previously separate. I think that's a really brilliant recognition of the fact that, when we as a people have control over our spaces, they will inevitably develop in ways that are conducive towards our mobility.
Absolutely, indeed. Like a city exists out of arbitrary boundaries that that is something that's created. Different pieces of land with walls that divide the different pieces of possession, and that can be sold and traded, used for speculation. Once we get rid of this idea, how we use land and property, we can connect many of the buildings and use structures that can be perhaps even generic structures that can be used for residential use, for storage, for agricultural use, and where we can move freely in between these buildings and structures, and where we can devise new rules about how we can use the land, use the buildings. Within a community, these things can all be agreed on between the different communities, and that's what you see indeed happening here. The lines where that you see in the present day city, where you obviously see, oh, that's a corporate building, that's an office building, that's a governmental building, they become blurry and more blurry, and you see that the city becomes more one large city of the commons that can be used by all its residents. Following rules that are that are in the benefit of all the residents of the city.
Right. I have a question about certain specifics of this piece. Another thing I wanted to point out as well, there's now in the introduction of a pond or a stream of some sort that allows for, animals to, move freely in this space and utilize the space for their benefit as well. But my question was related to the what are those structures that have been added to the building to the furthest left, with the blue and yellow tubes
Yes,
or.
okay. Yeah. That's actually a concept from the Japanese futurists of the past, Kikutake. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. and he devised many concepts. One of the concepts was some sort of pod tower in which the different pods are living units or housing units, very small units that have minimal of functions but are just enough to live. And he devised this concept. Well, why did I add it? Because now we come into an age where there's less tension. So, like I think that could happen, it creates space for new designers, architects to devise new ideas. And what you often see is that they look back in history and futurists of the past that didn't get in their time the credibility that they deserved for their concepts are rediscovered. And those concepts are tried and redesigned. And perhaps this era will be an era where you see old futurist concepts come to life that back in the days never got the chance to be created, which doesn't mean that these concepts are the best suited or best feasible concepts for that specific time, but it will be more a symbol for a new flourishing culture where new ideas finally can be created. And perhaps in the early days, I think that old futurists will deserve the credits that they used, they will get the credits that they deserve that they didn't get back in the days.
Fantastic. I think we could let the video evolve some more. And let me just take a second to respond to this one person in the comments here who asked, how can such a city be sustained? Once it costs insane amounts of money, where will you get this money? This will most likely take place in the first world. Won't they use wealth from the third world? As amazing as this looks, it seems like just wishful thinking. It seems, as amazing as this looks, this just seems like wishful thinking to me.
Yes.
You want to
Yeah,
take this and
you go.
okay,
Yeah. If you were one first, Andrew, go ahead. If you have an idea about it, I can answer as well.
sure. So I suppose I think this obstacle of money is something that I think it's the wrong starting point when you're asking questions about this project, because at the stages we were looking at that point in time and in future stages of this particular artwork's development, we are looking at a society that has been fundamentally transformed both in terms of values and in terms of structures. We're looking at how people have, we're looking at the people, the city itself, coming together in a variety of decentralized and cooperative organizations to transform directly, without the mediation of corporations or states, their living spaces. A lot of the developments we see here are as simple as the transformation of rooftops or the, institution of bridges or the introduction of urban gardens and the, what's the word I'm looking for? The vernacular, introduction of vernacular materials, transform spaces and whatnot. It's not something that we expect to be established from the top down, and nor do I see this as a transformation that can only occur in the first world through the reaping of resources from the third world. To me, this is a transformation I can very easily see with very little resources being introduced in capital city of my country, which is Trinidad and Tobago. I see these changes being able to take place really all over the world because our capacity to manage our own affairs and transform our fate, to transform our society and the world and the spaces around us is something that all of us are capable of, but have lost the capacity to, if that makes sense. In the sense that we all have the potential to develop our ability to self-manage and to develop our ability to organize our society directly. And the society we live within, the material conditions we are within, do not facilitate that capacity. In fact, it suppresses and degrades that capacity. And so this transformation of the city is really a visual and aesthetic manifestation of a broader social transformation. It's not that we expect that, oh, tomorrow, the government's just gonna introduce these changes. It's something that we know we'll have to fight for and implement by through with ourselves through direct action and things of that nature. Money's not really factoring into this stage. This is a bottom-up transformation based on a revolution of our powers, of our drives, and our consciousness. And really, you could check out my videos on the Solarpunk City and on social revolution that get into this a little bit more, because I don't want to take up too much time discussing this. But those are some, I suppose, launching pads for further exploration on that topic. You could also look at, someone mentioned in the comments they want me to do a collab with Anarch, and we've been planning a collab for a long time. It just hasn't come to fruition yet, but you could also check out his channel because he talks a lot about this sort of bottom-up transformation. And now I give the floor to Dustin to also address this if you'd like.
I think you give a wonderful explanation about it, and I relate to your answer. Yeah, when it comes to monetary policy and financing these things, we used to think in a way that we are learned to think about financing. So, for instance, if I would say, let's create a new form of sustainable transport, what you think about is this will cost huge amounts of money to create factories or to create cities or whatever. So what you need in order to get this done, you need to go to a central bank that can grant you the money, can get a loan from a centralized bank that uses a currency that's used over the entire world, the monetary currency. But that is actually also a weapon of capitalism. It generates a power concept, a power dynamics, in which it's impossible for anybody besides capitalists themselves to have control about production, about architectural development.
Oh,
And as
that's
long as you get a
sorry.
finance way,
You
the power
wanna
remains within those
roll back a little bit?
who control it.
My connection seems to have dropped briefly there. So, if you wanna pull back slightly and just repeat that last couple of statements you made.
Well, what I was saying is that the typical way of financing large projects is something that is used as a power tool within the capitalist society, and large factories for production of cars, development of large airports. These are multi-billion-dollar projects. And we used to think about if we need something, we need to have huge finances to construct this. But this is from within an old capitalist paradigm. I think we can evolve towards an entire different economic reality. Perhaps for me, it sounds logical that we move to a polyculture monetary system. Now we have a quite a monoculture economic system, but as you all know, a monoculture system is never healthy, is never sustainable. So there can be a multitude of different currencies and different value exchange models. And if you would say we need to construct this city all at once and finance it according to the old financial model, yes, then this is something that cannot be paid off. But I think the key is in stop thinking in the old centralized financial dollar, euro, yen monetary policy, because these kind of monetary theories are used to grant power to those who that are ruling. and we need to move towards and actually many other value exchange models have been devised in the past, but they are suppressed as many other good practices, because the moment they would emerge more and more, then the power from the current system becomes weaker and weaker, and the control becomes weaker and weaker. And another thing that I would add is what you see here is, of course, over many years. So it's not today, tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. It's over many years. And remember, it starts from what exists. And it starts from what exists are the buildings that already are built by capitalists and by corporate players.
Yeah,
so it starts
starting
with
from
adapting
scratch.
Those. Yeah, you're not starting from scratch. You're not building this. You don't use bulldozers to flatten the entire city and rebuild it again. That is actually the weakness of many of those arcologies as well. You go to some barren land and you build a city from scratch. No, you start from what exists, and what exists is the relics from a capitalist society with its many towers and large buildings, and you try to retrofit and use those buildings. And in the beginning, this can be with low tech and the material that is available within a city, and there's so much material available in a city. If you recycle and upcycle in a smart way, you could get along a long way with the materials that you can use and within the city itself. And over time, new means of production of new sustainable materials will emerge, but they will not use the monetary policy and the economic models that we used to use today. There will be new models that will evolve together with the communities that will emerge. So that's, I think you need to look at it more from that perspective and less from an old monetary perspective.
Well said, very well said. One thing I'd really add to that is, I suppose my position is more of the money abolition variety, but that's partially because I have not done enough research onto the sort of polycultural monetary math approaches that you mentioned there. And so it's definitely something I do want to research and maybe cover at some point on the channel, because there really are a variety of approaches we can take to tackling and transforming our economic system from the bottom up.
Yeah, and in general, I always think that is a polyculture system, just like in nature, and any ecosystem exists of a network of many different species that altogether form a balanced food network. And once there's a disturbance, the network itself responds and generates a new equilibrium, a new balance. And that's the power of a network and of a multi-species ecosystem. And I think with many things, it's the same. We see this in agriculture, and why not in an economic value system as well. They can all be part of a larger system, but perhaps the power lays within a polycultural system. Actually, perhaps, Andrew, also important what you see in these images is that in the background you see that the city starts to stretch towards the distance in the background. So the city grows.
Yes. Yeah.
That's an important aspect, because we need to house many people, and we misuse our lands. So we because of the car, we had the ability to move to everywhere and create infrastructure, and we created a patchwork of our land, which the problem now is that we don't have space for nature anymore, so we desperately need to change that and use our space more cleverly, and we are capable in doing so.
Agreed. There's a particular line that you had said there regarding, just in general, you know, polycultures and polycultural approaches to things. It reminded me of the of a quote, and I just had to Google it to make sure I delivered it correctly. The subcomandante Marcos of the Zapatistas, had said that in the world we want, everyone fits. We want a world in which many worlds fit. And I think that's a really fantastic encapsulation of what it is you're referencing there.
Powerful quote.
I don't see anything else in this particular stage that you had wanted to point out.
Well, the only thing is, we are with a lot on this planet, and I think many of the divisions that you see, especially within the environmentalist movements and nature movements that are based on nature, you see that they say we need to give land back to nature, and in order to do that, in the end, it means we need to abandon many of the infrastructures that we have built everywhere to give nature back all those square kilometers and miles of land. But as it also means that we need to devise or create cities where we can live more densely, but still not live on each other's backs. So that's why we devised the urban reef, and that's actually an old concept. It's created by Soleri himself. Many of the arcologies of Soleri were part what he called the linear city. The cities that you often see portrayed in Soleri's work, the arcologies, are the nodes within an urban map. And this urban that concept revived Eric Hunting, actually. Yeah, this work is about Erica's work. He revived this concept as well, but he dubbed it the urban reef, a more organic form, where you have cities, existing cities that we all are familiar with and that exist for a reason, and you connect them, and the connections become the urban reef and can be used for housing and for industrial needs or for agriculture as well. But the land in between, that becomes wilderness, that becomes land for the nature.
So we
If it needs to
rewild the
be this,
spaces between the major cities, essentially.
yes. And that doesn't mean that there's no residential use anywhere in between the large cities. There will definitely be eco-villages and historical places that are worth to preserve them. But you need to have ideas or concepts about how can we give back so many land to nature where we don't and where we will not interfere with zero interference of humans that's needed for nature to recover.
Right. I was really wondering about the sort of warpy, wavy sort of design going into the horizon there. So that's a really interesting concept, and something I'll definitely do more research on as well. I think there are a
Yeah,
couple.
that was something that Soleri realized as well, that we need to use land more cleverly. And Eric Hunting has revived this concept as well in this particular book about living city.
Right. And so now we've reached this stage in the city's transformation.
Yeah, and this is actually a tribute to Luc Schoten's work. I think this is most Luc Schoten-like image, where
Yes.
I think that the cities that Luc is trying, has worked on his entire life, because he's already in his 80s. So, and this is where I think Luc Schoten, his world comes to life, where we an era where we perhaps have invented entire new forms of science, where biologists and ecologists collaborate with architects and are doing research in an entire new form of science that is much more coherent and much more in connection with nature, and where we start to find solutions to, for instance, grow houses. And I have worked on many concepts how this could be done. So now, in the image that you have seen, you see an overview of such city, but I have made many detailed illustrations as well. How could this be in means of construction? What kind of techniques could be used? And actually, Luc Schuiten as well, he did some studies about techniques that are used in the forestry business to grow trees in all kinds of direction, to manipulate trees. And he has used these techniques as well in his architecture. And perhaps this era could be an era where humans mastered these techniques and have come to an entire new form of architecture that is indeed more a form of living architecture and that looks more natural. And so you see this emerging here in this image.
Right. I mean, it's really fascinating how dynamically the original structures have been transformed at this stage. If you were to, I suppose, give a timeline to this city's transformation, how many years would you say has this developed since, I suppose, the beginning of this change?
That's difficult. I think it should be possible if you see how fast that everything evolves, and if you see how many unbelievable discoveries that have been done in the recent years, but they don't find its way into the society like you see portrayed here in this illustration, because many of the technologies are mainly used in a way, how can we make it profitable within a corporation? How can we create it for our own profits? Then that's not always what the general public wants or what we want in a more distant future. But this research and those brilliant researchers are everywhere in the entire world. So if we manage to go to a networked system of communities that use other a polycultural economic system, we could perhaps go very fast to new scientific breakthroughs, and perhaps within 80 years or 70 years, perhaps that's possible. But that all depends, of course, how long will this class war keep existing. So it's difficult to predict that accurately.
Fair point.
Yeah.
And of this stage, what do you see some of the major transformations?
This is actually so in the paper of Eric, he always said that one of the key elements that is blocking new mass architectural development, something that is also not portrayed in Luc Schuiten and his work, is that we need an easy material like Portland cement, but that is a material that is not carbon neutral but carbon negative, so sequestering carbon and actually taking carbon out of the air, which we don't have yet. And bamboo and natural materials are not sufficient, not good enough to create large-scale urban development to move towards a next stage. So if you read the paper, you would see that he devised a concept where they do some form of mariculture and where they devised a new form of bio-cement that is actually based on carbon-negative design policies where they where use it's a mix between, I think, bacteria and some sort of algae species that is mixed with another material that binds everything and that can form with the proper added research a new form of material that can be easily produced on a large scale and makes it possible to create the most weirdest shapes of buildings. And because this could mean that in other parts where there's less development or where there aren't any cities, that they could benefit as well from this large network of communities that have a developed web of cities and the urban region between. It could connect other parts of the world as well because they have an easy material that can be constructed, because remember, the cities all were all built on the relics of the past, of existing cities.
Right.
Okay, so that's this new material, which is a good carbon negative material that you see, and that's the brownish organic shapes. I must add a small detail. If I would redraw it now, I would take it much, much thinner. So that is, in my opinion, the way how I showed it here is a little bit too thick. So I think that if we are so far in the future that perhaps computational design of this new material, because it can be steered and used by artificial intelligence and computers, that the material will be much more thinner. So it don't need to be that thick and that, because that's quite a waste of material. So if you use tensile structures and stuff like that, we could devise smarter structures.
Right. And this, I believe,
this is the final page.
The final page.
Yes, yes. And this is a stage where you have designed an entire living city where the material is actually intelligence and acts like a plant. So we have by that time so many years of research that we found materials that are nature, and partly nature, partly technology, but that can act like a plant, like a living organism that can grow from itself, and that can grow structures not only for humans but for any species that need it as well, that can enhance the soil, that can retreat if it's needed, if so it uses sensory devices of animals that it mimics, it uses pheromones to communicate with other structures, and it can actually swallow old buildings and consume it like fungi do. And it can even design and create materials like we do, like species do. They, from within an egg, an entire life form gets born. From a nut, a tree grows to the vast, enormous, magnificent structures that we see everywhere. And this is actually happening on an urban scale. We have devised a material that acts completely in harmony with its environment. So that's the final stage of the solarpunk city.
And just for those who missed the beginning, I'll let the whole thing run through so they can see the transformation over time.
Yeah.
We don't have too much longer. Again, I had told you about an hour and a half. So I suppose it's up to you. We have some pieces. I have some pieces of yours that we could look at, and also, we could also field some questions. But I think we've been taking some questions here and there from the audience throughout, so there's that as well. If you want to send me any of your specific pieces that you want to talk about, we could do that as well.
No, it's fine. Everything is fine for me. Questions are fine, or if you have other artwork that you want to discuss, it's. I think these artworks already covered many of the topics that I have been working on.
Indeed, indeed, indeed.
Perhaps something that I forgot to mention is many of the cities, and especially the last one, what you see is that that it's also exists of platforms. These are inspired by the rice fields that you see in tropical Asian countries, and the advantage of this platform terrace architecture is that you have a lot of roof space that you can again use for agricultural gardens, parks, so that's those platform terrace cities are coming back quite often in many of my illustrations as well. And these are all illustrations of Arctea, so in different stages, more less very distant future, but
Right, yeah. I see, for example, in One Piece, see a lot of walkways going through rewilded environments, like sort of elevated pathways. I see the
Yes.
shelves of some buildings being used as vertical gardens. I
Yes.
see.
Elevated ways are, for instance, this one in particular. So if you go back to the last one, is based on a city, Fredericton, I think, in Canada, where we said, the city is standing in the middle of a natural bioregional ecosystem, and it's a disruption, it's a disturbance of a natural ecosystem. So all species that are living there can't get in to the city. They need to walk around or get around the city. So we have some nerve by doing this without any shame. So it's in this city, humans, it's an existing city, humans realize, no, we need to take care for all species, and they decide to demolish a part of the city, part of their historical buildings, and create some sort of passages for wildlife where humans aren't allowed to come into. So it's only allowed for species, and I think that's fair. We didn't allow them to enter in our cities, so it's quite fair if you have more the role of a caretaker, that you allow other species to have their space as well in the city. That's the least that we can do, and this is actually what you see here. So what you see is that there's a large part underneath that's not accessible for humans, but that species can go from one side of the city to another side in the city. So they no need to go around the city, and then you have, of course, practical needs. We have to get from one part of the city or to the other part of the city. So then there are elevated walkways or tunnels that can solve that.
Right,
So
that's really
perhaps not
brilliantly
that.
done. By the way,
Yes.
Mark is in the chat.
Oh, great. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, I see here. This one is I really appreciate. This is like a educational setting, correct?
What was your question?
No, just asking that this is a if this was an
Okay.
educational setting.
This one is an educational setting. This is indeed the school of tomorrow, where you see, like a school is now. It's the school of tomorrow could be a workplace, a place where they discuss ethics of manufacturing, where they learn from each other, where the teacher becomes student, student becomes teacher, those kind of dynamics. And there can be a garden with an edible forest as well. So all those things merge. They don't need to be devised in different buildings. It's more natural to have, again, a more polycultural look at how we organize things. But still, the main focus can be, of course, learning. And in this case, it's learning about creating bicycles and electric bicycles and forms of more sustainable for transport. That's what you
Right.
see here. And you see it's more open structure, so you can walk in. It hasn't the many thresholds that many educational systems have today. Even today, our educational system is quite depending on class. Everybody knows that there are several universities or schools that are not accessible by the working class. Only the elite can go to such schools. And this thing, no, everybody can walk in and learn and or help to design new bicycles or manufacture them. So that's a more holistic, wider approach, broader approach.
It's beautiful, and I'm sure a lot of people in my audience would have appreciated attending an institution like this, or really visiting a place like this and being a part of it.
I hope so.
curious. See, let me there's another set of pieces as well. I know this one in particular, which is the floating city, is a concept that you actually have an explanation for on your website, right?
The floating city, so this one, yes.
So I don't.
Yeah, that's one that that's a concept that I've made for extension competition of Extinction Rebellion once. So it was part of a story that was written by Christopher Moscato, I think, was wrote a story about a floating city, and it's again inspired by a concept that I have worked on together with Eric Hunting, about what, how can we build on the open seas, which is extremely difficult because the conditions on the open seas are so harsh and so difficult. But one of the concepts that we devised that can be used perhaps in more shallow water or quieter waters is based on PSP platforms. So that's pneumatic platforms that change according to the wave powers and adjusts. So you can search that on the internet. You find plenty of information of these systems. They are used for temporary platforms on water, and we devised this concept where you have blocks, like several blocks, to build cities organically or structure organically. You can start small, but what you see is also that the buildings only start at level 2, level 3, level 4, because even if you want to have the idea to build something on the open water, even in more quieter water, waves are getting are coming and can be pretty high even in calm waters. So it's very difficult to build something on the level of the water itself. Plus, you need docking space as well for ships to dock and to deliver their goods. You see polyculture, mariculture system, and the reason why these buildings are quite vernacular architecture was because this was in the story that has been written, that the buildings were. I think it was from a Balinese, Balinese figures that were part of the story. So that's why I've drawn these vernaculars here. So that's a little bit about this type of city. But I have worked out how this city could evolve it. Units that break the waves and stuff like that. But we have done many sketches about this concept as well. And this type of structure could be seen in one of the earlier pictures that you've shown that was created for Mark, his Arctia book, that it's used as a marketplace on a lake. So
Right.
it's. And I think it's quite low tech approach. It's not because many cities on the open sea are multi-billion-dollar projects that are so expensive that they are never realized or never created. But this could start small and could become bigger, like Lego systems. You can start small, but by adding Lego blocks, it becomes bigger. Yeah, I hear you see it. So this is the same structure that is used here on typical Canadian lakes that are more quiet, but can be used to create lake settlements, aquatic settlements.
Right. As we have very little time left, for those in the audience, we did say about an hour and a half for the discussion, but I just want to find out from you, Dustin, if you're okay with answering two questions that I saw that I saw in the comments. If you'd be able to answer
Yeah,
those
sure.
real quick.
Yeah,
The
sure.
first is from David Lozano, who asks, how do you envision the changes in production and manufacture in a solarpunk society? How do you think education and work overlap and relate in said society?
Yes. Well, to give you an example, for instance, the I can answer this with an example of an existing well-known type of industry, the car industry. So if you would say the car manufacturers, they devise the vehicles that we need for transportation means, and of course in the past there were gasoline fueled cars, but in the future perhaps now it's our electric cars, and perhaps in the future new type of sustainable cars. Well, you don't need a multinational corporation to develop cars. What a multinational corporation does is they created an industrial assembly line to create that's very profitable within a capitalist society, and it can never be copied by no means by a community of people. So you could think and say it's impossible for us to devise and to create cars or bicycles, but actually it isn't. If you would go back to the medieval time, then you had carriages, and every village had many craftsmen that designed the carriages that were used for the horses to pull. And a solar punk society would not exist from a dozen multinational corporations that create Teslas in huge factories with large Henry Ford-like assembly lines. No, it would exist out of thousands of small manufacturers that create a polycultural system of all sorts of vehicles that can use standardized design formats that can be shared in open source systems everywhere in the entire world, but the varieties will be enormous. So the design principles can be uniform by using the open source principles, but you in any city you will see like the Jugaad system in India. And I think we need to think more in such terms. We need to think more and how can we take the best designs, open source them, share them, create very good assembly and design manuals about them, and how can we establish small workshops where we can devise them locally, and how can we create a workshop system in any city and in any community where hundreds of craftsmen design and assemble those tools, and it can be bicycles, can be whatever. So it's another model. So we need to step away from the large-scale billion-dollar factories. That's from the past.
Yeah, we need to look at more localized production, you know, reducing the length of those supply chains and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and use clever designs. And you can look it up if you would to the African continent. In India, they have great Jugaad hacks of many tools and designs that are locally designed, and in Africa as well, they get tons of scrap and materials that come from Europe and other countries, and they devise it and use it to design entirely new designs. So we could look at African craftsmen and learn from their craftsmanship how they can reuse recycled and upcycled materials to design good, clever designs. And especially in the beginning, in the early days of solar punk, this will be needed. Because as I said, there will be an era where there isn't a new large-scale industry to support us. So we need to think more cleverly with the materials that we have. And we have one thing that we have done in our capitalistic consumer societies, create huge, huge, huge amounts of waste that we can reuse. So I think that's key. Many more small workshops that use clever designs, smart designs, because what you see now is in an industrial society, it creates so many designs that are actually bad design, but are designed to sell. That's what they do, but we need clever designs that can be the same basic design will come back again, but there will be varieties depending on local resources that are available.
Absolutely. And just to grab this last question before, because I know you have to get going. Jadzia, or Jadzia Thickness, asks, the only thing I've wanted to see more of in urban concept art is accessibility for wheelchairs or limited mobility being integrated. Wonder if there's any resources for that anywhere.
Yeah, that's a great question. And indeed, I have to admit that it's something that don't have many disabilities, so I don't sit in a wheelchair. So my normal way of designing and thinking is from somebody who doesn't operate a wheelchair. But it's absolutely true. If you don't think about it, you again design cities that are not accessible for people inside a wheelchair or with other disabilities. And I have done once a workshop with a group of people and asked them to go through my designs and say what's wrong with it. And yeah, of course, they saw many things that they say, that's not accessible, that's not accessible. First thing is that as an artist, I try to be aware of it, but I would say it will never be me that will discover how or what is needed. I think somebody like me or other artists need to collaborate more with people who have different views about accessibility and about what the limits are of the designs that are made. So it's a co-creation process where many other people need to be involved to help create better designs. So actually, any design that you see here should perhaps be redesigned again so they are more accessible for people with wheelchairs as well. But then some designs already try to take this into account as well a little bit. I try.
Yes, I noticed in some of the pieces there's definitely I see like representation of folks with wheelchairs and other mobility aids as well. I think we can call it there. Dustin, thank you so, so much for your time and coming on and discussing your art, explaining some of the concepts, you know, really reaching back into all your experience in this field, and all the research you've done and all the knowledge that you've gleaned. And I think the audience would have really appreciated that as well. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, you're welcome, Andrew. It was a pleasure to be a guest of yours and was an honor for me. So, and I hope everybody enjoyed it, and I hope to collaborate in the future as well and design the solar punk future of tomorrow together, collaboratively.
For sure. Take care.
Take care. Goodbye.
Bye. All right, folks, thank you for tuning in. Like I said at the beginning, this live stream will be available in my live streams playlist on my channel. I don't keep my streams on the feed for very long, so if you ever want to rewatch it, if you want to send it to your friends, send it to your family, send it to your classmates, send it to whoever, you can do so. The link will always be this, and you can always get that link in the live stream playlist as well. Be sure to check out my recent video on some solar punk solutions. And, you know, it's interesting, he mentioned some topics here that I'm going to be addressing in my final video of the year, dropping in December. Thanks to all of you who tuned in, don't forget to drop a like, and until next time, all power to all the people.